from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Today, we look at whether the strict shelter-in-place orders that the San Francisco Bay Area implemented more than 2 weeks ago are having an effect. It's still early, but doctors say that hospitals in the region are not seeing as rapid a surge in COVID-19 patients as they feared. Meantime, the Bay Area is rolling out even more restrictive measures. We learn what the new rules are and whether other California counties could follow suit. Join us after this news. This is special statewide coronavirus coverage from KQED. I'm Mina Kim. More recommendations and restrictions are coming down. Governor Gavin Newsom made official that California schools would not reopen this academic year. L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti is telling people to wear masks. And counties in the San Francisco Bay Area are implementing even more restrictive shelter-in-place orders, including closing playgrounds and dog parks and banning most construction projects. The orders come as health officials and doctors say there are signs the Bay Area's early restrictions may be flattening the curve or slowing the rate of coronavirus infections. We take a deeper look at what the Bay Area is doing and what lessons there might be for other California counties. Joining us is Dr. Jahan Fahimi. He's medical director at the emergency department at UCSF and associate professor of emergency medicine. He's part of the UCSF team leading the COVID-19 response. Welcome to Forum, Dr. Fahimi.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Erin Alday. She's a health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks for being with us as well, Erin Alday.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Erin, I want to start with you. Give us an overview of some of these new restrictions that the Bay Area counties have put in place.
Right. So earlier this week, six counties, and now I think we're up to, I think all nine of them have extended the shelter-in-place regulations at least through the end of April, and most of them through May 3rd at least. And on top of that, they basically tightened the restrictions that were already in place. And a lot of that was about closing loopholes that had been identified. So places that they'd seen people still gathering in groups, both outside and inside, and, you know, places where people were shopping and still kind of coming into too close of contact. So they did things like shut down, you know, all playgrounds, shut down basketball courts, tennis courts, golf clubs, I mean, the golf courses, places like that, picnic areas. And then they're asking, you know, or demanding all these businesses that are still open to just put policies in place that keep them clean and that keep their customers separate.
And they even regulated sharing balls or sports equipment.
Correct. So, yeah, so you can only play like a game of pickup basketball with the people that you live with, so your family members. So there's no, you know, I live in Berkeley and I was still seeing a lot of people out on the basketball courts every night just, you know, playing around, and I guess that's just not allowed anymore unless you're with your own family or the people that you live with.
And it sounds like more people will be losing work, especially those involved in construction.
Yeah, so there are new, they shut down a construction unless it's, you know, it can't be deferred, you know, it's essential construction. So yeah, we're going to see more job losses from that.
So people basically who are doing additions or renovating their homes, that sounds like it's come to a standstill.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I think if you're in the middle of like a bathroom remodel, you'll probably be allowed to finish that. But short of that, yeah, now's not the right time.
So, Dr. Jahan Fahimi, are these restrictive measures truly needed?
I mean, it's a very good question. I think the answer is yes. I mean, we look to see what's happened across the globe. We look and see what's happened in New York. And then we can look to see what's been happening in the Bay Area. And you see a divergence between the experience around the country and what's happening in the Bay Area. I mean, the surge of coronavirus cases might still well be coming, and probably is, but it certainly has been delayed. It's been pushed out a substantial amount, seemingly. We thought 2-3 weeks ago that we would be dealing with this massive surge of infected patients by now. And that surge has yet to come. So I think these efforts are working. And I think that it's not, I think it's the prudent thing to do to double down on them now and to really say, everyone's gotten used to this now. Everyone understands what it means to shelter in place and to distance themselves socially. Now let's tighten up those processes. Let's make it even more effective than it has been.
So then what are you actually seeing, for example, at, you know, UCSF? And then why is it now at this point that you can begin to say that evidence is at least pointing to the possibility that shelter in place is working?
Yes. So we continue to see cases of COVID-19 infection every day. It's not that they're not happening. It's just that the volume of patients that we take care of in our ER, that get admitted to our hospital, that require our ICU level care, is less than what we thought. And the trajectory of those cases is different than a lot of other regions throughout the country and throughout the world. And so I think the biggest thing that I can point to right now is that the social distancing, the shelter in place, has delayed a surge of patients that are infected. And this does a few things. One, yes, it might be flattening the curve. I think it's too early to know that definitively, but maybe there's some room for optimism that when this is all over, we'll look back and see that the curve in the Bay Area was in fact flattened. Right now, it's maybe a little bit too early to say that definitively. But what I can say is we've bought ourselves some time, and that time is absolutely critical. For my team of doctors and nurses and staff at the hospital, the fact that we haven't gotten the surge yet means that we've had more time to prepare. And that preparation is making sure we have the appropriate protective equipment, learning from our colleagues around the country, in particular from New York, evaluating different therapies, building out capacity, training workforce. All of these things make it so that when the surge does hit in earnest, we have the expertise and the capacity to meet that demand much better than we would have if the surge was already here.
And is it also, you know, we implemented these orders in the Bay Area 2 to 3 weeks ago. Is that about the time when you would have started to see patients with symptoms, basically? So that's why you can start to evaluate as of now?
Yes, I think that's right. I think, you know, what we know about the course of illness is that patients will get infected. They're asymptomatic. There's this, what we call an incubation period that can last up to 2 weeks. For most people, it's somewhere in the 5-day range, but obviously everybody's a little bit different. But the outer limit of that we think is about 2 weeks. And then once people start to develop symptoms, it might still be another week or so before their symptoms are so bad that they find themselves in a doctor's office or an ER or worse yet, hospitalized. And so once you've had about, you know, 2 to 3 weeks go by and you haven't seen this huge spike, given how exponentially the growth of the infection can be, we can start to say, well, something is working. You know, that the spread is not as rapid as we had projected, you know, 3 weeks ago.
And I should note and underscore what you were saying, that it does not mean that cases are not rising daily, because they're not, that they're just rising at the slower rate that doctors are hoping to see so that it doesn't overwhelm the health system. That is currently what trajectory we're on at the moment.
That's exactly right. And I appreciate that nuance there, because that's exactly right. I think people need to realize we're not at a point where we're seeing a decline in cases. And I think we're a long ways away from knowing that. What we're seeing is that the rate of rise is less than what we would have expected without these measures in place. And the other point that I should make is a lot of people are quick to say, well, maybe we just don't know how many cases are out there because we're not testing as broadly as we should. And that may be true as well. However, even if we're not testing everybody, and there's people out there who are infected that we can't detect, we're still not seeing the severe illness, the people that require going to the ICU in the numbers that we would have projected. So regardless of testing, I think that we're seeing fewer cases. I think there are fewer cases in the community than we would have expected at this point in time without the policies in place.
Well, Aaron Alday, why are you hearing doctors, analysts being so cautious about saying that the Bay Area could be flattening the curve, even with everything that Dr. Fahimi is saying?
Well, and I think, it is exactly what he's saying, which is, as he wisely pointed out, we don't know that we're flattening it. We know that it looks certainly from the numbers so far that we're slowing things down. And, I've been following these numbers really closely. And, we've been showing statewide and in the Bay Area between about 10% and 15% day-to-day growth in cases, which is, as you pointed out, still a growth. We don't want to see that growth. But it's nothing compared to New York last week was seeing 30%, 40% increases day over day, which is just why it was just explosive over there. So that seems like pretty good proof that we are slowing things down. But the problem with this whole flattening the curve thing is you don't really know it's plateauing or flattening on the top until you're kind of well into it. It's hard to get a sense of that until you're a couple weeks into that sort of plateau to know that that's what's happening. But I think he, very wisely pointed out that that's sort of the phrasing everybody uses because I think we can all picture that and understand what that looks like. But he's right that the main purpose here is to give these hospitals time to get ready and prepare. And we're certainly doing that. We have certainly pushed this thing out farther. There's a lot of models out there, and I'm always very skeptical of models. Models are, they're based on projections and stuff that are often not quite right. All those caveats aside, the models that we see for San Francisco and the Bay Area and California compared to the rest of the country show us sort of reaching this kind of capacity level, this kind of surge in patients much farther out than every other part of the country, just about. And that's because our numbers are just not growing that quickly. So we are that is this sense that we're in the middle of that. We're reaching that flattening of the curve. We're headed certainly in the right direction, but it is just so hard. It's hard to identify yourself on that curve when you're in the middle of it.
We're talking with Aaron Alday, a health reporter over at the San Francisco Chronicle, and Dr. Jahan Fahimi, a medical director and emergency at the emergency department at UCSF and associate professor of emergency medicine. We're talking about early indications that the Bay Area may be flattening the curve or slowing the rate of coronavirus infections, and whether there are lessons for the rest of the state and even the country. We want to hear from you. What questions do you have about flattening the curve, about the Bay Area's efforts, shelter in place generally and its effectiveness, or anything else that you'd like to ask our doctor and reporter? Call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. So, Dr. Fahimi, should the rest of California be adopting these kinds of rules that the Bay Area has?
Well, I think, the data from the Bay Area is compelling. And if there's one thing we can point to that makes us seem a little bit different than everywhere else, I think it's that these policies were put in place early. I think, it's better late than never that you adopt these policies, because for any region that is still seeing substantial growth in cases, you might be able to slow that down. Obviously, it's going to be less effective the later you implement these policies. And that's just a function of exponential growth. But yeah, I think that everyone should be looking to these policies, recognizing that they seemingly are having some effect. And to the extent that it's possible, I think that they should be adopting them.
That said, though, we just got some really sobering unemployment numbers in California that, new claims of 878,000, 6.6 million in the U.S. as a whole. So to implement anything like this, right, is to really have to weigh whether or not it could potentially create other issues, even health issues with that are related to loss of work and things like that.
Absolutely. And I think about this a lot. The loss of insurance we know is associated with worse health. Patients may defer reaching out for appropriate medical care because they're worried that they're going to be left with large bills in the absence of health insurance. I worry a little bit about the mental health that's associated with, you know, the shelter in place, the loss of job and wage. These are not insignificant issues. I guess, you know, I don't have a crystal ball, but, you know, if we look at New York, for example, for contrast, you know, their shelter in place came, you know, later relative to where they were in this outbreak than the Bay Area. But the outbreak itself, I feel like, caused a lot of panic. It caused a lot of isolation, even without a shelter in place order. So I worry that just, you know, just the fact that if you let the virus grow exponentially and, you know, damage our society by just causing lots of infection, that we're going to be left in the same place where people are afraid to go out, businesses will go out of business, will have to shut down. To me, it's almost like an analogy between, you know, having a wildfire spread out of control versus having a controlled burn where, you know, you can sort of expand and contract that burn to prevent it from getting out of control. If we have the appropriate social support systems in place, in particular around universal healthcare coverage or universal access to basic medical care, and ways to support people through this difficult time financially, then I think that we have the ability to turn this into a controlled burn and come out of this with the least amount of pain.
You know, Aaron, all day I asked Dr. Fahimi about whether the rest of California should be implementing some of the measures that the Bay Area has taken. LA Mayor Garcetti has recommended that folks there wear face masks. What has the governor said about this?
So the state public health department last night issued new guidance, which kind of towed a line. It basically said, you know, that I think the thing they're worried about is they don't want to put out this message that everybody should be wearing masks because masks are in short supply. So the last thing we want is to have everybody in the state, you know, trying to get a hold of masks that we really need to be saving for the front line, you know, for the healthcare workers. But, you know, increasingly, because there's so much potential for this to spread by asymptomatic people, and masks, you know, they're sort of questionable in their effectiveness of preventing healthy people from getting sick. So like if I'm a healthy person and I put on a mask, there's sort of limited evidence that it's going to keep me from becoming infected. But if I'm, you know, the evidence that if I'm sick, if I'm the person who's infected, that a mask will prevent me from giving that to somebody else, that's pretty good. And so if we have a lot of asymptomatic people out there, you know, if that's one of the things that's driving these outbreaks, then, you know, the argument is that it might make sense for more people certainly to be wearing some sort of face covering to, you know, further kind of stop that spread, to put one more kind of barrier in place. So I think that's where that conversation is now. And the state public health department basically said, you know, people, you know, can consider wearing masks. They should not be using the surgical masks or the N95s that our healthcare workers need, but they can fashion, you know, cloth masks. They can put, you know, a bandana around their face. They can put, you know, pull a t-shirt up over their face. They can do something like that when they are out in public. And that there's, you know, there's some evidence that might help. I think it's interesting because one of the concerns is that having people do that might give them a false sense of security and kind of make them think, well, if I put a bandana around my face, then I can go on a hike with my friend and not worry about it. And they certainly don't want that to happen. But at the same time, that can also be a good thing because it might be further kind of cues when you go out in public. Oh, right, we're in the middle of something. I need to keep my distance from all these people. It's just sort of a visual stimuli that this is, you know, reminding us what's going on. Not that many of us need that reminder. So I think it's, you know, it's still sort of, it's up in the air. Supposedly CDC is going to put down some guidance sometime soon. So hopefully we'll get more answers about that. But it sounds like it's, you know, if people are reassured by wearing a mask out in public, then by all means they should. But again, not using the mask that our healthcare workers need, but fashioning something of their own.
Well, let me go to some calls now, and I'll start with Trudy in Orinda. Hi, Trudy.
Hi. So left over from the fire, I have an N95 mask, which I've been using to go to the grocery store. I'm over 70. And I wondered if I put it in hot, soapy water for 15 minutes and then rinsed it thoroughly and dried it, if it's effective.
Thanks, Trudy. Dr. Fahini.
Well, we're not 100% sure, but probably if you are immersing an N95 mask in hot water, it's going to degrade the effectiveness of that mask. We're actually very eagerly trying to figure out what are best mechanisms to sterilize masks. And, you know, obviously getting them contaminated with water and soap and those kinds of things actually may make the mask less effective. So, you know, I think if you have a clean mask, your best bet is to just keep it clean and try not to sterilize it or do too much with it. I always recommend people wash their hands thoroughly before they take their mask off, trying to avoid touching their face. Take the mask off in a way that doesn't make the outside of the mask touch your face. Store it in a paper bag, and leaving it just in a paper bag to sort of air out is probably the best way to keep it clean and sort of let any bacteria or viruses, anything that are living on there, sort of die out on their own. And then make sure you wash your hands immediately after you've taken your mask off. These are policies that we implement in the hospital for healthcare workers. For the most part, I think if you're wearing your mask to go to the grocery store or to be out in public, it's very unlikely that the outside of that mask is going to be contaminated. So it's overall fairly low risk. But if you want to be extra careful, those are sort of some of the best practices to repurpose and continue to reuse that mask for a long time.
And these are policies you're implementing because of the shortage of masks and other PPE, or because my understanding was typically they would be disposed of in a day.
Yes. And so this is a challenge for us. These are policies that I think even 3 months ago would have not been in line with our standard policies and procedures, right? These are one-time use disposable masks. But because we are looking at how long this this outbreak might be lasting and how long we're going to be taking care of patients with COVID-19 infection, we need to be very mindful of our supply chain of these PPE. And so a lot of effort is going into how can you be good stewards of the PPE that we have and make sure that, you know, a 1 week supply can last 2 or 3 months. Because, you know, we don't know when we might get another huge shipment of N95s or surgical masks or gowns or gloves.
Well, this listener writes, where are the patients now coming from? How are people contracting the disease now? Dr. Fahimi, there's this projection that the surge of patients would come in late April, early May. Has that been modified at all? And we're coming up on a break, but just has that calculation changed a little bit as a result of the curve? 20 seconds.
Yeah, I think what you can see is that the projected peak keeps getting pushed out further and further and further. So I'm skeptical of all these models that tell us when they know the peak is. I think we'll know when the peak is passed.
And again, we're talking with Dr. Jahan Fahimi of UCSF and Aaron Alday of the San Francisco Chronicle. And you, our listeners, stay with us more after the break. I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to special statewide coverage of the coronavirus from KQED. We're talking today about early indications that the Bay Area may be successfully flattening the curve or slowing the rate of coronavirus infections and whether there are lessons for the rest of the state. We're talking with Aaron Alday, a health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, Jahan Fahimi, medical director at the emergency department at UCSF, an associate professor of emergency medicine. And we're talking with you, our listeners. What are your questions for our guests? Give us a call at 866-733-6777. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook or at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. And let me begin with Caitlin in San Francisco. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and say I'm an emergency room nurse in San Francisco, and I just wanted to say we aren't seeing as many patients as obviously as we are in, as New York is. And as an ER nurse, we're getting many support from communities saying thank you for being a frontline worker. But like the doc has said, we don't want to call, or we're not predicting the future, but I wanted to thank the public because it does look like the shelter in place is working. And as an ER nurse, I never wanted to make decisions of who is going to get treatment, a disaster zone area. So I wanted to take a time and call in to thank everyone in the community for actually taking the shelter in place seriously, because as of right now, it is seems to be working. So thank you. I know it's really hard. I know it's hard for the parents homeschooling their children right now, but thank you for taking it seriously. And
Caitlin,
that's what I wanted to say.
Incredible to hear you thanking us, because I feel like we should be thanking you for the incredible work that you're doing at this time. I mean, you truly are like a frontline soldier at this point for all of us, and we really appreciate it.
Well, no problem. It's all, this is unprecedented times, so it's nice to see that we're all working together. So thank you for your program, for educating everybody. Thanks for the doctor and the other person educating us today. So thank you all.
Thank you. And Dr. Fahimi, is it right to say that this strategy of flattening the curve, it really is a long-term strategy? I had been reading reports about how in places where there is a very dramatic spike, there can also be a very dramatic drop. But a flattening the curve strategy is actually a strategy that people have to really be ready for the long haul. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, when you look at those curves, those graphics that people try and show what flattening the curve really means, you can actually see, you know, that the peak that you see is much lower and much later. And so, yes, if you let the virus just kind of spread rapidly, you might be onto the other side of the outbreak sooner, but the peak is so much higher, so many more people are affected. And so by flattening it, really what you're doing is you're saying, I'm willing to sort of receive or get infection, cases of infected patients on a slower basis, knowing that it's going to last a lot longer. So this turns it in from a sprint to a marathon. And yeah, I think we really just have to be prepared to continue to stay the course, to kind of double down on our efforts now, especially when we see that it's starting to work.
And I know no one in the healthcare field wants to give a projection about how long we could be in this, but do you have any range?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I have to say this with a caveat that this is purely speculation. This is not based on anything other than, you know, maybe a slightly educated guess. I think that what the reality is, we're going to, now that schools are closed through the remainder of this year, I think we'll probably be in some version of this shelter in place until summer. And then with the warming weather, it's entirely possible that the spread of the virus will slow down because of seasons, right? We see this, you know, there are lots of different types of coronaviruses and other respiratory illnesses that circulate every year. They tend to wane and decrease in the warmer months. And so it's likely that naturally we'll start to see a little bit of decrease spread and transmission of this virus as the weather warms up. So we may get to the summertime when things start to feel a little bit closer to normal. And maybe we have the opportunity to sort of ease up some of the restrictions. It's entirely possible at that point we'll have better testing capabilities so that we can test people a little bit more rapidly and broadly and sort of have a little bit better sense of, you know, who's infected and who's not, who needs to be quarantined and who doesn't. But I worry a little bit about, oh, go ahead.
No, please finish your thought.
I was going to say, I worry a little bit about this idea of what happens in the fall. You know, we know that these viruses come back when the weather starts to cool off again. So schools will reopen potentially in August and September. And then as the weather cools off, are we going to see another peak in late fall? And is there anything that we can do proactively to sort of mitigate that before it happens?
Well, I'd like to bring Jeremy Ude into the conversation now. He's dean of the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Minnesota Duluth and an expert on global health politics and policy. Jeremy Ude, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so we're hearing Dr. Fahimi talking about the long haul, the marathon of this, and it makes me just wonder, what are people's tolerance for this? Because we're already hearing reports in other countries, in Italy in particular, that people are no longer, for example, singing on the balconies in social solidarity, that social unrest is mounting as a result of these strict social in place orders. So what are you hearing about the situation there?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting question and really interesting time for all of us because it is such a big challenge to how we are normally living our lives. And when we're talking about something like coronavirus, we're talking about disease that's spreading across borders so easily. So we need to have the sort of coordinated type of action. And I think that what we're seeing in Italy and in other places really speaks to the need for government officials and public health officials at all different levels to be communicating on a consistent and a data-driven level to make sure that people know why the decisions are being made, how they're being made, and how they'll evaluate whether or not some of these policies need to continue going on in place. One of the things that has happened in Italy is that there has been this mixed messages that was coming from government officials. And I think that helped to confuse some of the matters and also then maybe led to some questioning about who was the right authority and who people should be listening to. So it's really important now for government officials to really get out in front and make sure that there's that clear, consistent message that is coming from trusted sources.
Well, the mayor of Milan says that until there's a vaccine against the virus, any reopening of the city will be tentative. And, you know, we've also seen reports that across Asia, countries that seem to have brought the pandemic under or the epidemic there under control, they're suddenly now having to put in some stricter measures again. So, I mean, how tenuous is all of this?
Yeah, I mean, and that speaks to how much of a weird situation we're in, because not only are we trying to get these policy responses to this this outbreak, but we're also just trying to learn about the virus itself and trying to understand the dynamics of how it's being spread, whether it's going to be something that becomes seasonal, as the previous guest was just mentioning. There are all these things that are still up in the air. But what is important at this point from a policy perspective is that we probably need to err on the side of being conservative, that even if we are starting to see things moving in the right direction, we can't assume that this is just a switch that we can flip and go back to how lives were. And, you know, we do need to be driven by the data about whether or not some of these policies that are being put in place, some of these shelter in place restrictions, whether they are effective and, how we are actually assessing them. So it's, I would probably agree with the mayor that there is probably going to be a process of two steps forward, one step back, and we're all trying to navigate this process in the midst of trying to just learn about this disease.
So then, Dr. Jahan Fahimi, anyone tempted to say, okay, we're starting to flatten the curve here in the Bay Area, maybe we can relax a little bit and start going outside and playing basketball, what would be your message?
My message would be the same thing I sort of alluded to earlier, which is we don't know if the curve has been flattened or not. We'll know once we're on the downslope, when the number of cases are decreasing. And until we know that, I don't think that anyone should take any liberties with taking their foot off of the gas pedal, so to speak, of this social distancing. So it's hard to know. And once we are on the other side of it, once the cases are decreasing, I think what we really need to do is message that you can cause a resurgence or a second peak if people quickly return back to, you know, the way things were prior to this outbreak. And so even if we are going to ease up on some of the restrictions, I think it needs to be done in a very thoughtful way. And it also needs to be done in a way that, you know, maybe people will behave a little bit differently in public spheres going forward. You know, we might see more people wearing masks on a daily basis. We might do travel and airports a little bit differently. We might have restrictions around, you know, large gatherings like concerts and stuff. So, you know, it doesn't mean that it has to be all or nothing. We can start to ease up a little bit once we start to see the cases decreasing and really moving in the right direction. But I don't think it's the right answer to sort of say, go back to life as usual.
Well, Gary writes, logic might suggest that people living in rural areas are somewhat less vulnerable to COVID-19 than people living in densely packed urban areas. Is there any data or general observation to support this idea? Aaron Alday, your thoughts for Gary.
You know, we've seen some reports of that. It's a little bit hard, at least in California, to say that because the reporting here is just entirely on the county level. And frankly, even getting the county data has been somewhat challenging. But, you know, we're not really able to track this by cities, by census tracts, by anything that would let us kind of differentiate which communities are being impacted the most by that. I think that's something that's really important, and it's something that we're certainly starting to push back on. So hopefully we'll get more information. But I have seen reports out of other parts of the country where they do have a little bit finer level data that are indeed showing that there is sort of greater impact on those communities, which, you know, sadly, there is a logic to that.
Well, let me go to Gail in Santa Rosa. Hi, Gail.
My question is, what is it possible for the state or the counties and even the U.S. order tests now from the World Health Organization to supplement our testing? Even though they give more false positive results, the hospitals will still treat only the more severe cases.
Gail, thanks. Let me put that to Jeremy, actually. I mean, has the ship kind of sailed on WHO tests? I mean, given the fact that we're still not testing nearly enough.
Right. I mean, that's absolutely a crucial question. I think that there could be still an opportunity for having that collaboration with WHO and trying to draw on some of those tests. You know, the question that really comes up has to do with some of the regulatory structures that we have in the United States around the certification of medical technologies and making sure that we've got policies in place so that we could understand how these technologies work and make sure that they are something that we're comfortable certifying for use in healthcare facilities.
You know, Jeremy, I never feel like I got a really satisfying answer as to why the U.S. declined the tests in the first place. Besides, you know, Vice President Pence was quoted a lot as saying that's just not the way America does things. But could you shed any light on that?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that, you know, the tests that the WHO was putting together were largely targeted towards more developing countries that had weaker healthcare infrastructures. But also there is this question about how we regulate medical technologies and some of these diagnostic tools that we have. And this is not something that's unique to just these particular tests, but there are a lot of questions about, you know, if a drug or a technology is permitted in one country, the United States doesn't automatically then allow it in the United States for a variety of different reasons. And so you've also got this complexity that comes into play with the regulatory framework that we have in place here. And that's certainly something that the United States could change. And we obviously have the ability to do that. But having the political will to try to tackle that and figure out exactly what, you know, which other regulators we might look to as saying, yes, if this other regulator is okay with this technology, we'll also be okay with it. That's a pretty big discussion, and one that we haven't seen Congress willing to take up yet.
Well, Andrew writes, even if we dramatically flatten the curve, isn't the bad news out of all of this that the only two options for us returning to life as normal would be if there's a vaccine or if we're able to manufacture and distribute an infinite number of tests? South Korea literally has phone booth type testing that anyone can get on the street. We are nowhere close to being able to provide this level of testing to our citizenry. Dr. Fahimi, your response to Andrew.
Well, yeah, it's tough. You know, I think the vaccine is hopefully going to be promising. I don't have any inside information, but, you know, maybe a year from now, we will be at a point where we can start to really start rolling out vaccines and see if that provides a significant amount of immunity for people. That might go a long way. The testing piece is critically important, obviously, but, you know, testing alone doesn't actually stop the spread. I think what you need is a broad testing strategy that's accurate, that gives people good information, and then something to do with the results of that test. So, you know, if I test negative, does that mean I can do anything I want and I have, free access to behave however I wish in terms of my interactions with the rest of society? And if I test positive, what happens? Is there going to be, you know, some sort of quarantine process for me? Right now, the tests are not perfect. Even if you get a negative test, there are false negatives. So people who actually have the disease could test negative and continue to go out there and spread the disease. And people who test positive sometimes don't have the capability to appropriately quarantine themselves. So testing is going to be really important. It's going to give everybody a lot more information. And there's smart ways we could use the results of tests, but we also have to recognize that there are significant limitations.
Well, Pat writes, when will tests be available to find out if we've already had the COVID-19 virus? Antibody test, Dr. Fahimi?
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about potentially using antibody tests. And my understanding is that that's something that is very feasible to do. But again, I think we need a little bit more time to understand, when these antibodies are formed in the body, how long they last for. Does the presence of the antibody necessarily mean that you have immunity, or could you get reinfected despite having the antibodies? So I think as we start to see more and more people recover from COVID-19 infections and doing analyses of those folks, we might get a better sense of what that immunity might look like.
And again, Jahan Fahimi is medical director at the emergency department at UCSF and associate professor of emergency medicine. We have Jeremy Yude with us, dean of the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Minnesota Duluth and an expert on global health politics and policy, and Aaron Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. And I want to look now at some potential hotspots, Aaron Alday. One of the things that has gotten a lot of attention here is the San Francisco nursing home, Laguna Honda, where they are trying to keep an outbreak from getting out of control. There are also some signs of contagion in Los Angeles County nursing homes. Can you talk about some of the hotspots that you're seeing?
Right. So we're definitely seeing a few of these nursing home hotspots in California and other parts of the country. And, those are certainly probably the things that I'm most concerned about, just because those can get so bad so fast. Because these patients are so vulnerable, and it's really hard to, put in social distancing there. They're all in one place, and it's not like you can necessarily very easily remove people from that situation. I know that at Laguna Honda, they've brought in CDC, they've brought in the state public health department, so they have investigators who are, on the ground there trying to contain this. I think at Laguna Honda last I heard there were 10 staff members who had tested positive and 2 patients. And then they have tested, I think, about 100 other people. But there's 780 patients there, I think. And again, every single one of them is vulnerable. So that's a very concerning situation. And, I think a lot of people have their eyes on what happened up in Washington State with the facility up there, which was sort of the first big outbreak in the United States. And that just, it was one facility that this virus just tore right through, and it killed a lot of people. And that's obviously what everybody is really trying to avoid now. And hopefully they identified it early enough that they can get a handle on things. But I think we're still in the middle of that, and we're still waiting to see how that plays out. Because as Dr. Fahimi pointed out, this thing can kind of lurk for a long time before we necessarily know what's going on in an individual.
And Jeremy, globally, hotspots that we should be on the lookout for, places that should be doing shelter in place.
Yeah, what keeps me awake at night, or where I'm really worried, is as we start to see more cases popping up in countries that have weaker healthcare systems, because we may not have the infrastructure in place to be able to find those cases, to identify them, to do that sort of surveillance, and then also to be able to have people who can be in a position where they are able to self-isolate or to go into quarantine. So we saw a few days ago the country of India essentially going down on a nationwide shelter in place. That's more than a billion people. And as the doctor was saying, it's one thing to have have these policies. It's another thing whether you can actually do something with them, if people can actually live out these sorts of recommendations that are coming from policymakers. So I think looking at some of those countries, particularly in South and Southeast Asia, we're starting to see some cases pop up in Sub-Saharan Africa. South Africa has gone to a similar sort of nationwide stay-in-place regime. And that is potentially useful. But again, if you don't have the infrastructure there to provide some sort of assistance, to be able to provide some sort of healthcare services, we're in a real danger position.
Well, let me go to caller Liz in Oakland next. Hi, Liz. Hi, Liz. Are you with us? And while Hello? We wait to connect with Liz, is that you, Liz?
Yes.
Oh, go right ahead.
So I can't really hear you. It's really breaking up. Oh, I'm on.
Yes, you're on, though. What's your question?
Am I on?
Yep. Loud and clear.
I'm here on the phone. I hear you on the radio, but the phone's breaking up. Can you hear me?
Okay. Well, maybe what we'll do is we'll try to reconnect with you in a moment. And in the meantime, this listener tweets, I'm not going to allow my children to attend school in person until we have a vaccine. I can't be the only one with this concern. Dr. Fahimi, is this listener, should other parents be doing what this listener is doing?
Well, it's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Obviously, that's not going to be, you know, even the last few weeks of, you know, the shelter in place has made it very challenging on families throughout the Bay Area. And so could we realistically expect everyone to, you know, skip another school year potentially, or another half a school year? That's going to be hard. I don't know the answer to that. We're going to have to kind of wait and see where we are at the next academic year and get a sense of where are we on this curve? What does the outbreak look like? What's feasible? What are some alternatives to traditional school? I trust that our school boards and our policymakers will have some guidance for us. But at some point, I think everybody's going to have to go back to school. And waiting until a vaccine is available, maybe that's on the horizon. But that also seems quite daunting, especially since we don't even know the efficacy of a potential vaccine at this point.
And this listener, Bill, sort of echoes this. Bill writes, I believe many people right now are getting an existential angst or frustration for sheltering in place. This may cause people to give up out of personal anxiety crises. You know, some thoughts on how much tolerance we do have for all of this for the long term and what it may require of us. I'm being told that Liz is back on a more stable line. Hi, Liz. Are you with us?
Yes. Hi. Sorry about that. I'm just calling, as a single person, I'm seeing a lot of these things coming out for families can go play basketball together, but single people, I know we're feeling really isolated and feeling like we're not allowed to even just connect with each other, even if we are isolating ourselves. And it'd be nice to have some recognition of our situation and our social needs, even if we're, not able to, we can still socially distance, but like, what can we do to be sort of recognized as part of this fight as well?
That's such a good point, Liz. I mean, Aaron, all day, for example, closing all these loopholes of places we can't go, like public picnic areas or basketball courts, unless we're sharing balls within the same household. But if you're single, you don't have a lot of people to do that with.
Yeah, I really relate to that because I'm single and I live alone. I will say, and I'm not recommending this. I'm not encouraging this. Like personally, I have like my sister and a brother-in-law and my nephew in town. And we created like a social contract. So they're I'm counting them as part of my household, and Dr. Fahimi can chastise me if that's problematic. But, I do think, it's important for people to have, maintain relationships. I have found, I have other single friends that we've been getting, doing video happy hours and chats. We've been definitely amping up those sort of interactions. And I have found those. I was really hesitant about them. I didn't think they would do much for me because I'm not a big fan of that. But I've actually found them really enjoyable. They've kind of taken some of the pressure off. So that's been nice. Just yesterday I had a coworker come over and sit at the end of my driveway. Hi, Sarah. And we had a really nice long chat, appropriately far apart. But, you know, sometimes those kinds of connections can do a lot for you. And, you know, I I've been writing a lot about this. I completely endorse social distancing. I think it's obviously critical, and I'm never going to encourage people to bend the rules or to not do that. But I do think, you know, that especially people who have no household contacts need to kind of think about, you know, how they can reach others and how they can connect. I think it's so important because, you know, Dr. Pahimi is absolutely right. I mean, this is hard, and the mental health aspect of that is important, and we can't be overlooking that. And I know that I'm glad that person called also, because I do think that's something that we should be talking about and writing about, you know, in the media. And that's just kind of a good reminder for me.
Yeah, and we are trying to do that here as well at KQED. And so, Liz, thank you. And to our listeners as well, we are with you. We are going through this with you, and we feel you. And hopefully, as you're saying, Aaron, that, you know, it won't get to the point where penalties or enforcement will start to ramp up for people who are tempted to break those rules. Well, thank you, Aaron Alday of San Francisco Chronicle, for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to you as well, Dr. Jahan Fahimi of UCSF.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And Jeremy Yude of the University of Minnesota in Duluth, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to our listeners, especially our partners across the state, including at KCLU in Thousand Oaks, KVPR in Fresno, KAZU on the Central Coast, and KVMR in the Sierra Foothills. This special statewide show on the coronavirus is also produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Ariana Prale, Blanca Torres, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our interns are Michael King and Jameson Weiss. Our executive editor is Ethan Tobin Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.